This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Autumn Caron writes for a living, but rarely gets to see her name in print. Autumn is a ghostwriter, and most of the projects she pours herself into end up on bookshelves and blogs with not even a hint that she is the woman who wrote the words. That changed with a recent publication. Autumn's name is prominently displayed on the cover of a book that she wrote. It tells the incredible account of a black civil rights advocate who ended up inside a white supremacist hate group. Mississippi Still Burning, From Hoods to Suits, tells the story of James Hart Stern and his path to the unlikely position as the leader of the National Socialist Movement, a neo-Nazi hate group. James Stern is the author, but my guest, Autumn Caron, is proud to say that she also wrote the book, and she joins us now. Autumn, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you.
I want to hear your story, but talk about James Hart Stern first and tell us about the story that he tells in the book.
So James Stern is an activist and a reverend out in California in Los Angeles. He ends up wrongfully imprisoned on federal racketeering charges because he was involved in a company that he was the head of. The other people committed wire fraud, but he was the big dog. So he ends up in prison, and they extradite him to Mississippi from California because the wire fraud crossed state lines. So through, and this is all documented in the book, he had previously been an activist and worked out all of these gang negotiations between like Bloods and Crips during the 1991 riots in Los Angeles, but he ends up in prison and ends up all the way into Parchman Penitentiary, which is an incredibly, it's a massive federal prison in Mississippi, and it is home to all kinds of violent criminals. If you see pictures of him online, everybody's talking about his eye has a lot of trouble, and so he ends up in a hospital ward. And the story is long and winding to get there. He ends up in a hospital ward with Edgar Ray Killen. And if you're not familiar with Edgar Ray Killen, he committed the 1964 Mississippi burning murders. And this man is I get chills talking about it. He is a monster in every sense of the word. Okay, and what he does to people of color in the 1960s is far beyond what we can imagine. But James, I don't like the word befriends. James would never call himself the friend of these people, but he certainly advocates for this man because he does not believe anybody should be treated unfairly. So he protects Killen at great cost to himself from other prisoners who want to inflict harm on him, want to make him eat horrible things, want to beat him. So he essentially becomes a protector of Killen and then a confidant of one of the most notorious white supremacist killers in history.
He is because Killen at this point is confined to a wheelchair, right?
Yes.
He's helping to bathe him as well as protect him. Here's a man who was, it took until 2005 to finally get the conviction for the murder of civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi in 1964. But he's finally the head dog in that case. Mm-hmm. Who's there, and of course, at Great Rest Parchment Prison, by the way, has quite a history itself as a farm and as a place of the absolute enforcer of Jim Crow. It was post-slavery. So the fact that the feds decided to send him there, by the way, when they had, I think, other choices, right?
They did.
The mail fraud was national. They took a civil rights activist who was a peacemaker in Los Angeles, who actually brought peace to various gangs, particularly post Rodney King, sent him to Parchman Prison. So I just wanted to make sure we underscored that. Then he becomes a defender and advocate for one of the most virulent, violent racists that we've ever caught.
He does. And Killen confessed to James in a series of letters, which are published in our book, dozens of other killings. The atrocities don't even come close to what we see in the Mississippi burning murders. There are worse things, and there are things that we have not published yet that are forthcoming that we're going to put out there. It's unimaginable what happened. And the thing is, it's not in the past. Killen is infirm. He's in his 80s in this prison, and he is still communicating with prison workers. They're prison workers who give KKK signs back and forth, because Killen was the grand dragon of the KKK. He was the owner of it. And in prison, in order to help to rehab the views of the KKK, Killen ends up signing over ownership of the Ku Klux Klan to this black preacher, and which is incredible.
So tell us more about how that relationship developed. First, you said, you know, generally that James felt nobody should be felt treated unfairly. Give us a deeper sense of what his commitment to his faith was that allowed him to take on that role.
Well, James walks in, and when he first meets Killen, Killen uses the N-word, uses racial slurs, and that's like the go-to for what he calls James. So there's never a reciprocation of friendship from Stern, from Killen to Stern. But he walks in, and some of it is a function of just human stuff, is that Killen smells really bad. And so he walks in, and they have to share this kind of prison cell in the hospital wing. And Killen just stinks. And so he's like, we have to do something about this. So he rolls the wheelchair into the showers and, you know, takes off Edgar Ray Killen's clothes. And Killen is a big guy. So if you've ever seen there's video of him and pictures of him. He's a big dude. James picks him up out of the wheelchair and showers him and bathes him in the most intimate ways. And that's kind of the start of their relationship.
How did it evolve? Because again, here's a guy in Edgar Ray Killen who is has not a kind thought about African Americans. Now he's being bathed, as you say, in the most intimate way. How did that relationship evolve?
So I want to make it clear that the relationship never evolves. Killen is never at all recondite. He has no remorse for anything that he's done. He never comes to like Stern in any other way. He calls him a dog. He talks about using him like a dog. It's always to use this African-American man to his own ends. And so Stern never has any love lost for Killen, but he does understand that matching hate with hate is not helpful. So,
but he does ultimately confess and then turn over control of his neo-Nazi organization to a black civil rights activist.
Well, that's actually he turns over the KKK. It's after he comes out of prison, and he comes out with Edgar Ray Killen's prison card, which is a prized possession, because for us, Killen is a monster, but for neo-Nazis, he's a hero. So when he comes out, Jeff Shoup of the National Socialist Movement, who was a leader in the Charlottesville and is currently, you know, charged with all kinds of stuff relating to Charlottesville, contacts James for Killen's card and then develops another relationship. So James does this twice. And so the National Socialist Movement was signed over to James Stern earlier this year. And he is currently the head of the largest neo-Nazi group in America.
What's he doing with it?
He is, I actually talked to him last night about it. He is committed to dismantling it. And
well, let's talk more about how you came to be involved in this story.
I was a special ed teacher. And as you know, in North Carolina, we teachers don't make a lot of money. May 1st protests are coming up. I hope you guys are all aware of that. So I needed to do something to help support my family. So I started writing lesson plans, and then I started writing blogs to go with lesson plans. Then that turned into ebooks, and then I was able to come home full time with my disabled daughter, and because I was able to make more money writing than I could as a teacher. And then I got signed on to a ghostwriting company, and that's how I met Stern.
You'd done other projects, obviously.
I had. I'd done lots of books before him. James was well aware that James is a man of equity. That's why he's able to do all these things. And so he refused to have a ghostwriter proper, so he insisted that my name be on the cover. And he and I have become good friends over the last several years.
So what was it like working with him? Because, on the one hand, a ghostwriter, okay, I'm not going to have my name on this. I'm a hired gun. I'm going to spruce up the prose here, and you can go get it published. I get paid. We walk home. This has got to be a different relationship as you get to know this man, or was it?
It was a different relationship. James and I have become, just very close. When I have trouble, you know, I've had hard times in my life, and I call him up, and he calls me up, and we talk, and we have a lot of shared experiences, losing children. We've both been through a lot of various difficult life things that we share and we talk about. And, he's called me up late in the middle of the night, and I've called him up late in the middle of the night, and it's just he's a great guy. The reason he's there, people ask me, what's the trick? How has he done this twice? It is nothing more than being a decent human being.
Well, it is more than being a decent human being, isn't it? Because I think we all figure there's no way I can do that. So when I hear those stories, when I hear the stories of John Lewis and how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee trained to be spit on and called names, I think, well, I'm out, can't do it. So was there anything you learned personally? I mean, just in being that close to the story and working with somebody, sort of the how do you do it, or did you become more confirmed that you could never do it? I certainly would. The more I heard the story, I realized, thank you for being there, because I can't do that.
I don't know. I think it happens with everybody that I write for. I develop a personal connection with a lot of the people. I'm writing a book right now that's an extraordinary story that I cannot say a word about because I have a non-disclosure agreement on it. But everyone who's been through extraordinary things in their lives finds a toughness, and there's like an inner steeliness to them. And I feel like James certainly has that. But then where he hits home and where I hit home with all of my books of these extraordinary people that I'm privileged to write for is they are still like us. That's what makes the connection. So he is extraordinary in that he did it. But then if you were faced with that same thing, I think many of us would rise.
Mm. What about the relationship? You're a white woman. He's a black man. Was that deliberate on his part?
It's absolutely deliberate on his part. He wanted a white author. He liked that I was from the South. Because I have experiences. I grew up in a small town in North Carolina where racism is alive and well. I taught in the North Carolina public schools where racism is alive and well. And he liked that. So
did you take on the role as a fact checker as well in this case?
So he starts telling me this stuff, y'all, and I'm like, I do not believe any of this. You are making this up. There is no way that actually happened. So if you flip to the back of the book, because I have research experience, I have doctoral work in clinical psychology, so I'm that fact checker. And so I would go in, and he'd tell me this extraordinary story, and then I would frame it in the New York Times and in research journals because it's all real. And in the three years that I've known James, he has never even come close to a falsehood.
Wow. Has this changed things for you as a ghostwriter? Are you going to be more picky about the stories you choose after writing such an extraordinary story?
I was always picky about, you know, I've written some things that I'm not proud of. I wrote for some presidential candidates in the last election to pay the bills that I'm not proud of. I don't have to do that anymore. And that's, I'm fortunate for that. I think the best thing about it is that I get to tell more interesting stories, and I get like more interesting people come up. So I have people solicit me now that I'm like, that's an amazing story. Let's tell it together.
I was going to ask if it does something for you as a ghostwriter to have your name elevated and on the cover.
It absolutely does. And it's I don't like taking credit for things. I like that I get to be kind of on the back end. I'm writing a book for a family called The Death Era right now. That's a family that lost their child to gun violence. And we're working on it from all four of them. That's a privileged work to be able to write. I just wrote a novel for a production company. It's looking for a publisher. It's a cross between 50 Shades of Grey and Bridget Jones's Diary, which is an extraordinary piece.
We'll have you back for that.
Absolutely. So I like to write varied pieces. You know, a lot of them have similar things that go through them, but because I have kind of a broad life experience myself, I connect with a lot of people. That's just fun. Like, I love doing it.
Mississippi Still Burning, what do you think is the impact? Have you had any sense of whether or not, I mean, we just had Robert Lee up here. We've had a powerful message of reconciliation over the past 32 minutes here in this past 32 minutes. Do you think it has broader impact?
I think it does. I think that realizing how ugly things still are is important, but then at the same time reaching across and realizing those are still people. We don't understand our white privilege, and that's the absolute truth. I walk through it, and I'm a single mom of three kids. Nobody questions if I have a baby daddy. Like, they don't question it. They assume that I'm a divorced mom who's raising kids by myself. If I was a black woman, that's not how the narrative would go. And so I think that we're recognizing that more, but it's also because we're seeing the ugliness more. And that's what James is doing. What happened in Charlottesville was really ugly. And that's what he is working to promote right now with the National Socialist Movement. These people are real. Jeff Shoup is like a name on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. He's also a real person who has a real story, and his backstory is incredible. And you can understand why he got where he is by looking at his past. So,
yeah. Do you have a more detailed sense of what James plans to do with this organization, how he plans to transform it?
He's working with the state of Michigan right now to dismantle it. When Jeff Shoup and the folks there, you know, he kind of pulled the rug out from under them when he signed over to James, and they were not happy, and they're still not happy, so they're trying to wrestle control out from him. But he's a hardcore guy.
Autumn Caron is the author of, actually the writer of Mississippi Still Burning, From Hoods to Suits, and you can find out more about her and her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you so much for being with us, Autumn.
Thank you.
We thank everybody here in Greensboro today. Also, Andy Eversole, you'll hear a little bit more of his music. He's going to be at Banjo Earth Band at the Carolina Theater in Greensboro on May 25th. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. John Hardy helped out today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stasio. Once again, Andy Eversole.
From the sun on your face, you wake up this morning to find a ray of starlight. It's traveled to you from a distant space, bringing you the love that makes your days bright. Time rolls on beneath the sun. Plant the seeds when the spirits tell you so, and watch your garden grow with a little rainfall. The light of the world will be there every day as you kneel down to pray. Thank the grace of God above. Time rolls on beneath the sun.